listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Chris Mueller is a national speaker, author, father of six, and is currently making a Catholic TV show for families as he travels speaking to over 10,000 people each year. Between Chris having over 18 years experience in Catholic lay ministry and Timmery's holding a master's degree in biblical theology, together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
Timmery here in studio. We're so excited to be with you. Chris and I have a major lineup today, a lot in the sports world from Kaepernick and Serena Williams and her meltdown over the weekend. We're asking questions such as, what is sacrifice?
Yeah, sports. I'm not a sports guy. So this is one of those things where it's like, yeah, I can talk about the social aspects of it, but the actual athletics part, nah, not so much.
So more to come later in the show. What is sacrifice? What's the importance of work in our lives? We'll get into the inner lives of men and so much more. But if you can't catch a full episode, head over to radiotrending.com. So Chris, this question, I think my take on the whole Nike Kaepernick ordeal is, what is sacrifice? Because here you have this ad, and at the heart of it is sacrifice everything, right? Even if it means losing everything, which Kaepernick has not lost everything. In fact, perhaps he chose to leave the football world and then no one would sign him after kind of having not such a great attitude. And now he's got this huge deal with Nike.
Yeah, you know, the Kaepernick question is an interesting one. And I think it comes down to everybody who has a platform bears the weight and the responsibility of that platform, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one respect, you go, okay, well, he really risked a lot by trying to, you know, this whatever social activism he's doing here, whether or not you agree with his stance, whether or not you agree with how he did it, whether or not you did it. I think what we see in our culture is more and more our celebrities, our entertainers are taking positions, mm-hmm. right? And I think that really affects the way that we as consumers have to approach things too. And again, you know, you look at Christian athletes, Christian performers who have taken positions, they've used their platforms to gain influence and how that's been received by the broader culture or the other, you know, kind of power makers of the media. And it's interesting. It's just an interesting thing.
Yeah. Well, and there's such a distinction between using your public voice on social media and then letting that impact how your job is run as well. And I think that that was part of the big problem. For those who don't know, just very briefly, because we're not going to get into the nitty gritty, Colin Kaepernick is the one who started the kneeling protest during the Star Spangled Banner in the midst of 2016. I think it was toward the end of the season. And then from there, it really took off throughout the 2017 season. And I'm sure from there, you guys are aware of what's gone on. What ends up happening is he ends up choosing to leave the 49ers at the end of that 2016 season. And then after that, he is not picked up by anyone. The Seattle Seahawks were willing slightly to pick him up only if he would guarantee basically that he wouldn't kneel yet again at the beginning of those games. And he refused to say that he wouldn't kneel. And so from then, people are saying, well, he's lost everything. So Nike now has adopted him. He's going to have his own entire brand within Nike, from shoes to jerseys, you name it. And the slogan is sacrifice, essentially, and sacrifice and, you know, stand for something. Or, you know, in the case of Kaepernick, he's lost everything, even if it means losing everything. And so that's why I want to ask the question, what is sacrifice today?
No, absolutely. You know, we've kind of made life about avoiding pain, avoiding sacrifice, avoiding being uncomfortable. I mean, you look at the middle school years, right? And I deal with adolescents. Adolescents tend to plateau academically, right? In middle school, and they explode socially, and it's super uncomfortable. Everybody, think back, if you're listening, think back to your middle school years. Everybody's uncomfortable in middle school, right? Because you're hyper socially aware. And so what we've done as a culture is we've said to them, here are these devices, here's these things to occupy your mind. Anytime that you're not occupied with school or activity or sports, we're going to just, you know, this is going to occupy you. And so you don't deal with what is it to be uncomfortable. And so the idea of sacrificing, of doing something willingly that's going to make you uncomfortable, it's going to put you in a position that you don't necessarily want to be in for a greater good. I mean, that is so foreign to our culture. Everything's about make me feel better, make me not feel pain. Anything that's uncomfortable is undesirable.
Nike taking Kaepernick with this idea that sacrifice everything, even if it means losing everything, it should bother you, because it's really gotten to the point where we don't even see what sacrifice means in our culture. Even if you just look at the word sacrifice has to do with an idea of something being holy, right? Sacra means holy in Latin. And sacrifice, any type of definition that you look at, has to do with some sort of religious sacrifice to some form of a deity, where you are offering something to that deity. And yet today, we think what heroism is, what sacrifice is for some is, well, you went into the wrong bathroom, or you went into the bathroom of your choice, and that's heroic. That's taking a sacrifice. Versus in reality, the sacrifice, when we sing those songs at the beginning of games, such as the national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, you know, saluting the flag, all of these different ideas, it has to do with honoring the men and women who have sacrificed so that you can live freely today.
Yeah, I think getting back to the idea of what is a sacrifice, and I like how you point that out. It was, you know, the religious offering of sacrifice, of giving something, giving honor to something. And I think where most of us really encounter sacrifice on a daily basis is going to be in family life. I mean, that's the reality of family life is sacrifice. And you look at our current trends in our demographics that, you know, people don't have kids anymore. Why? Well, sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're willing to make a limited sacrifice. People don't get married anymore, right? We're seeing the trend in millennials and in kind of the Z generation, I generation. They're kind of trending away from marriage. They're trending away from children. Why? Because you don't make sacrifice. Why? Because the God of my universe is me, right? And so why would I make any offering to anything else other than that? I want to keep my options open. I don't want to be encumbered. I don't want to do things that are going to make me uncomfortable or make me have to sacrifice. And it is interesting, you know, that this Nike's leading with this sacrifice everything. The other thing, I feel like we're so prone to want to be part of the virtue signaling social thing. And I'm not calling out Kaepernick in particular. I just think I see it with Catholics on the internet, right? Catholics going after each other on the internet about how devout they are. It's all virtue signaling, right? Or people bragging about their Lenten sacrifices online. I mean, this is my favorite thing about Lent right now, is that it's like everybody puts the ash on their foreheads and it's a thing to brag about. Like, it's your ash mark, right? Like, oh my gosh, hashtag, right? And it's like, dude, that's a sign of humility, right? That there should be something sacrificial in this act of penance. It's not like, hey, we're all part of the big Catholic club.
We're doing the exact opposite of what especially the New Testament talks about, is don't come out letting everyone know that you're fasting.
Right.
Yeah, that's what's happening on social media. That's where I think this total idea of sacrifice has been lost. It's giving something up for a greater good. And that greater good doesn't mean, oh, wow, I suddenly get signed with Nike. It doesn't suddenly mean that I get all of this attention because I said something that was, you know, not very favorable in the news. But it's that I'm giving something up for the greater glory of God, to be with him in heaven. And that's what sacrifice is ultimately meant to orient us toward.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's fair to say that Kaepernick did this because he thought he'd get signed with Nike. I mean, I think that's
not
unexpected.
What I was saying.
Yeah.
No, that's not what I was saying.
But you know, like, you're right. I think it is. It's giving up something for the greater glory. It's giving something up that's not for you, right? It's doing something that you don't get something from, because it's due someone else, or because someone else has a need from it, and to God or to family.
Right. And I'm not saying that Kaepernick was trying to do this to get signed with Nike, but I think a lot of people think, well, if I say this, there's some form of attention I can get. And I'm not saying this is what Kaepernick's attitude is, but I think our general attitude as a whole in society is that our sacrifices are very self-oriented and what we will receive from them in the end.
You know, I think Father Mike Schmitz, in talking about the current scandals in the church, said something really interesting, where he was said, you know, of course I'm angry. Of course I'm angry about this. But so much of what we see online isn't actually people. It's just virtue signaling. It's just people, because it's really easy to be angry, or to be really like a social media activist. It's really easy to do those things. But most of us aren't really willing to do the hard work of prayer, of fasting, of really putting in the time to work on our own personal holiness, right? Or, you know, like in a situation of an online thing, like, oh, I support Kaepernick or not support Kaepernick, or, you know, whatever it is. But there's something different about reposting a story than actually getting involved in my community, right? We don't know what sacrifice is, because everything in our culture has trained us to avoid pain, avoid, you know, instances that are going to make us uncomfortable.
I think a big remedy, and I talk about it a lot, but that is fasting. You know, first we need to work on, you know, deepening our prayer lives, especially in the midst of the scandal in the church. I think it's time for a reawakening of, am I just praying or am I going through the motions? You know, am I taking that time? Am I being intentional about it? And how is fasting being implemented into my life? And really fasting to offer that fast up for a specific intention.
Oh, yeah.
Or a purging of something within your own life that, you know, you yourself need to work on. And that's where I think sacrifice, we have that humble, contrite heart rather than just offering these big sacrifices. But it's the heart, the body, the whole person that's being changed.
You know, we don't talk about the sacrificial love between spouses where, you know, the overlooking of a fault. There's a sacrificial love there, right? Because you did an injustice to me. I have the right to make a big deal about that, but I'm not, because I'm going to have a sacrificial love and say, I'm going to overlook it. I'm going to overlook what I probably deserve, which is, you know, recompense, right? To say that I know, because my love for you is greater than that. And I want to get past this moment and not make this moment what we're going to be about. You know, you talk about fasting, and it's interesting, as a church, we say fasting, and what do we immediately think as Catholics? We think about Lent, right?
Right.
But we've lost like the richness of, as Catholics, we fast, we should be fasting every Friday. Mm-hmm. We should be fasting as just part of our life, as part of our devotion, and with purpose and intent. Lent is not like a 40-day weight loss program, right? It's for holiness, right? And we've lost that.
I had someone ask me the other day, do that thing where you fast before receiving communion? Yes, I almost want to say, yeah, I don't do that thing. I do what we're supposed to do out of respect for the honor of what we're about to receive, that we're saying, I'm going to make this little sacrifice right before I receive you, Lord.
Chris and Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at C. Mueller Tweets, spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R, and at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Timmery here with my co-host Chris Mueller. I just want to let all of you know that we are on Google Play, we are on Spotify, we are on a number of podcasting apps. So if you don't catch the whole episode, head over to radiotrending.com or your favorite podcasting app, and you can discover us there in different ways to subscribe to the show, because we're producing two shows a week. We're even live on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook. So if you want to check out what these crazy hosts look like, you can head on over there.
I think that's important too, because you may not get the super secret other hour because you're listening to one of the networks that only carries us once a week, right? And so there's a whole nother hour of content out there each week.
Or if you're on the live feed, we have different discussions off air, in between segments, before and after. Sometimes not so juicy. Other times we go a little more in depth with those who are joining us live in studio.
I pretty much just talk about how my kids have been sick forever. I just feel like that's, you know, I'm a dad of six kids, and it's, something's always sick. It's just the way it is. It's just the reality of my life. It's a sacrifice I'll make. Going back to the last segment.
So later on, we're going to be talking a lot more about work. We're starting that conversation here, but we've also been journeying through this book having to do with interior lives of men, and really looking at, why are some of these things so important to them? How are their brains totally rewired in a different way from women? And how can we respect the differences between femininity, masculinity, for ultimately better and stronger relationships, communication, raising of your children, respecting the masculine element of the young men that are being formed in your home, and even friendships and in the workplace. So right now, though, I want to talk about this big news this past week that I was kind of just getting a bit of a chuckle at, that we, man, just like blow things up so quickly. From The Cosby Show, you may remember Jeffrey Owens. He ends up marrying into the Cosby family. Well, like anyone, he is a talented actor. However, he has worked to make ends meet. And I guess not too long ago, he ended up taking a job at Trader Joe's. And since then, it's been blown up all over that, you know, this once notorious, famous actor is now working at Trader Joe's.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, because most people don't realize that getting a run on a sitcom, you make a lot of money, but it's not like you're not set for the rest of your life, right? This is like, and getting a run on a sitcom does not mean you're ever going to get another job in acting again. It's like, that's your moment, right? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. So when you watch those shows, that person's famous, but really they're just going to work every day. And it's funny how we make this cult of celebrity, but really that's just a guy doing a job who, when he's done with that job, may never get another job in that industry again. And he may end up bagging groceries someday.
I think part of the reason a lot of people have a difficulty finding a work-life balance is because we have such a deep idea that we care too much about what people think about what we're doing and how we're working, or that it looks like we're working. The perfect example of this is we're sitting here seeing people criticize Jeffrey Owens for working at Trader Joe's when he's got a good work-life balance, in the sense that I have to provide for my family, so I'm working at Trader Joe's, and this is what's necessary to provide for my family right now.
Right.
Yet so many people want to pull away from, well, I don't want to work so much, or I'm working too much, or I don't have this balance. Well, work is part of who we are as people.
Oh, sure. You know, I think it's also, it seems like such a transition too. You know, the Jeffrey Owens story, was it so much that he's working at Trader Joe's, it's terrible work at Trader Joe's, or you got a guy who you think lives in a mansion someplace and all of a sudden you see him working at Trader Joe's? You know what I mean? Because our assumption is people on TV, oh, well, they're all living this Hollywood lifestyle, you know? And a lot of times, you know, that run was good, but they didn't make that kind of money. But yeah, I love Jeffrey Owens' response. I mean, you're talking about like the dignity of work. Like, it's not, you know, there's nothing better about being a sitcom star than being a guy at Trader Joe's. I mean, there's nothing really inherently better about being a dentist than there is about being a garbage man. I mean, it's both work. It's both good work. It both provides for families. One pays more, but that doesn't mean it has more dignity. And I think that's where we get caught up. We're like, oh my gosh, how could I do that? Or these high status jobs. Honestly, if the garbage men stopped showing up, we'd all be in a lot of trouble, right? So we, what's the higher value job? Well, gosh, if that guy doesn't show up at my house every week, I've got a lot of issues real quick.
You know, this gets into, we've talked about it on the show a number of times before, but, you know, the idea of getting down and dirty again, this micro dirty jobs, you know, and this attitude that so many people don't want those jobs. There's actually a major skill gap in our country today where a lot of people prefer the white collar type of job and look down upon the blue collar jobs.
Right.
And, you know, that's what bothers me, is that we look down upon it. And I know so many people, I remember people that I graduated from college with, who they thought that they were entitled to this position within the field that they studied, but they had no work experience. So here they are, they get an entry-level job, and they're upset because maybe they have to carry boxes now and again, or maybe they have to be involved in some office work that they didn't want to do. And you hear all this complaining, but the reality is that real work, we lean in and we do what we have to do to get it done, because work is part of what is necessary to provide a lifestyle for each of us to live in.
Well, and I think it also goes back to that discussion we had last segment about, you know, we do everything we can to avoid our perception of pain, right? And, you know, so people perceive that job is less comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's less, you know, or pain is, it's less, it's has less esteem given to it. And there's a pain of feeling like you said, like worrying about what other people think. You know, one of the young men I've worked with over the years, he graduated from high school and he went to do like a semester of junior college. And he said, I hate school. I've always hated school. Why am I doing this? And so he went out and he got an internship with a plumber.
Right.
And he loves going to work every day. I mean, he's elbow deep in poo some days, but he loves going to work, right? And that's good work. It's good, necessary work. It's something, and you know, he should be absolutely proud of what he does, and he is, which is really awesome. But, you know, in his mind, he goes, yeah, I'm doing this, I'm learning these skills, and there's nothing but opportunity here in this for me. And I think we've kind of done this thing where we've said every student needs to go to college. Every student needs to have a white collar job. Every student needs to, you know, learn how to code or do whatever. And the reality is that there's a lot of work in our culture that doesn't require that. That's good. That's honest. That's paying. You can go home at the end of the day and you feel like I did something. I contributed. I made a difference today. And why should we steal that from people?
Right. And, you know, as you're saying this, that's Chris Mueller, my co-host Chris Mueller. You're listening to Trending. I'm Timmery Millington. You know, as you're saying this, Chris, it's making me think too of, even within our own jobs, we always have to find a balance. For example, I know that I have a hard time if I am in front of this computer screen for a long period of time, and I have to find ways to do my job that's not just in front of a screen. I know a lot of people who just hate being in front of screens to begin with.
Right.
I know some people who they could edit movies or look at numbers for hours. And so we need to be more friendly toward skills, and also broadening the skills that some people just at this point in age really have never even been exposed to. You know, I'm looking right here at the National Association of Manufacturers, and just some of the statistics Plastics. As of next year, there will be 300,000 welding positions just in trainers that will be empty. That's a major skills gap where there are jobs out there available, but people aren't filling them. And we could go through the list in different types of white collar jobs. And in fact, what's interesting, welders alone are making about $90,000 a year. Yet here people are really struggling to pay off student loan debt. They're unhappy in their jobs. It's something to think about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What's the return on investment? What's the REO, right? And so you go get a philosophy degree. You paid, $150,000 for your philosophy degree. What's the what's the return on investment for a philosophy degree? Well, like, it's terrible. I mean, the chance of you going out to be a professional philosopher is almost zero. But you could go to a trade school, learn how to become a welder, and be making real money immediately, and get yourself up to be a master welder. And now you're making $90,000 a year, right? Which is unimaginable money to some philosophy majors, right?
And I get the dichotomy. We talked about this about a month or so ago on the show that I get that desire to study philosophy, to study theology. I mean, that's what my degrees are in, right? But at the same time, there's a difference between forming the mind and forming a skill. And there are a lot more skills that are needed in life right now in order to provide an income and a way of living. And there's also a great need for further development of the mind in our faith.
Well, let's be honest, though. You can develop your mind outside of a four-year degree.
Exactly.
I mean, you can, I've got how many books by Peter Kreft on my shelf, right?
And
philosophy. I'm not a philosopher, but I can pick up a philosophy book and read it. You know what I mean? I've how many books by Scott Hahn do I have on my shelf about theology, right? Okay.
Right.
So it's, anybody can pick up a book. You can stop by your library. You can expand your mind. But again, paying $150,000 for that versus going to a trade school, what's the return on investment? The reality is we need work, and I see so many young people struggling today is that idea. And we've talked about this before. They do go to work. They do, go to school or whatever they're doing. But they approach each day and they don't really have a plan to be effective in what they do. Mm-hmm. And so they end their day feeling frustrated, right? And like, I didn't get anything done. I'm not achieving. I'm not succeeding. And so, the idea of we need work, but if you're not working effectively, that's when you start to feel like, oh gosh, I hate my job, or I'm not doing this. This is terrible. I want to do something else. It's because you never learned how to do it well or how to discipline yourself and push yourself. Again, back to sacrifice. You never learned how to be uncomfortable. So now you're totally uncomfortable because you feel completely ineffective.
You're talking about setting goals. You're talking about, in the midst of it. Also, the Catholic teaching, the idea of especially surrounding work is this idea that the subject of our work is always the person working. The person working is the subject, just like if you own a business, your greatest assets are not the things that you're making money off of, they're your people. And that's what's so fundamental about the Catholic Church's teaching on work. We have Rerum Novarum. We also have John Paul II's piece talking about the work as well and how important it is that at the heart of this, we have to remember one of the first things that we're called to do is, yes, to be fruitful and multiply, but also to fill and subdue the earth. And that was prior to the fall. We're called to work with the earth as a means of part of developing who we are as men and women.
Well, really, for the majority of Jesus' life, he was a carpenter.
Right.
Right? I mean, St. Joseph was a carpenter. No, Jesus was a carpenter. By the time he was 30, he was a carpenter. There were people who had a Jesus-made table in Jesus' town, right? And Jesus made cups and Jesus made bowls. And he did that. Why? Because he was sanctifying the human experience. There's not one part of your life that God hasn't come into and said, I want to use that to make you holy. I want to use that to make you like me. I've made it possible for your work to make you holier, to make you better.
Hey, if you're listening to us, you can also find Trending on Google Play if you are an Android user. So be sure to check us out there.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
We've been talking about Jeffrey Owen from The Cosby Show and how he was discovered working at Trader Joe's and the big to-do that was made about that. We're going to talk about Serena Williams in a second, but we're talking about how work brings so much meaning to our lives. Do you know that work is good for you? Now, the problem is that some people define and hold everything on their career and what they do, but the career, the job that you're doing, is meant to help provide a lifestyle. You know, we work to live. We don't live just to work. And that's an important balance that we have. When we were coming off that last break, we're talking about how one of the first things that God charges us with as male and female is to be fruitful, multiply, and then to fill the earth, to subdue the earth, and how we really discover who we are in a deeper way when we have that dominion over the things around us.
It's true that we are supposed to work to live, not live to work. And I think one of the things that our modern culture does to us is that it's so easy to feel like you're supposed to be working all the time. You know, whether that's your devices, your computers, all of those things, our boundary between work and life is getting blurrier and blurrier and blurrier. And as you're talking, I was thinking about that. It's just, you know, like you're supposed to work to live, not live to work. But how many of us bring our phones to bed and check email?
Yeah.
You know, how many of us, you know, when our kids are talking, have with a phone in one hand? And I'm, you know, preaching to the choir here. I just recently deleted email off my phone. I deleted all my social media off my phone again. And I gave my wife the password control over it, right? Because I figured I can't go back to my old ways unless I have to justify it. Because 90% of the time when I'm checking email on my phone, if it's something that's related to work in the evening, I can't really do anything about it anyway, right? Yeah. Other than stress about it and take myself out of my family situation. And it's just interesting how we've gotten all that confused. And so I think most people feel like they're not getting anything done. They're feeling completely frustrated all the time. Right. And no one's really healthier because of it. And where's the forethought or where's the awareness to just step back and go, yeah, I don't know if this is working. Like, it's not, I think we've gotten disordered.
And I like what you just said because it touches from different perspectives. One is from the responsibility of having a family, and are we meeting the responsibilities around us? And also, are we getting the rest we need? Are we hopping into bed checking those last emails? Or I know for me, I remember being taught this in college. We had some really awesome executives come into my business classes, and they would give just loads of advice. Like, these are the pieces of information we want to share with you. And I had multiple of those mentors come in, and they said, only touch something once, especially your email. So plan a time of day when you're going to check your email. Maybe it's twice, maybe it's three times a day. It depends on the type of job you have. But then from there, if you read it, deal with it. Don't just leave it in your inbox. Deal with it right then. And it was always such a good piece for me because I remember getting into different points of my career. And again, I don't have a family. I could get away with checking my email later at night or whatever it would be because I don't have all those people around necessarily. However, when I did that, I found that I was anxious. I had a harder time sleeping. I was then still chewing on those things when I went to bed, and it was the first thing I woke up thinking about in the morning. And, you know, similarly, if I start checking my email and hopping right onto the computer first thing in the morning, my focus is off for the rest of the day.
Yep. Well, and it's never just email. Like, anytime you touch your phone, it's never just the thing you thought you were going to do, right? It's, oh, I'm just going to check social media real quick. And then you get, blah, 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 you're done. Or I'm just going to check my email. And then you check social media. And then you check this. And then you check your that. It's never what the thing you thought you were going to do. It's always more than that. And again, you know, like we don't live to work. We work to live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we put ourselves in this rat wheel and we run and we run and we run and everybody's exhausted. And, you know, what happens is you find yourself distanced from the things that are really important, you know, and you lose the focus on that.
Mm-hmm. In his writing, Laborum Exercens, John Paul II talks about how work distinguishes man from the other creatures. And I've been chewing on this because I thought, why does work distinguish man from the other creatures? Because animals do things like creating nests, you know, hunting their food. But what distinguishes them is that we as human beings operate within a community when we work. And we operate within a community because it's meant our work to help develop who we are. So some people say, oh, you know, these are just my work friends, or that's just how I interact at work. But in reality, you're saying you're kind of two-faced. You have two types of personalities. The person we are at work and the person we are at home is the same person. And we need to be working on developing who we are because ultimately we're working within a community of people.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's what, you know, that distinguishes us from the animals is work. You know, because I get what you're saying. Like, well, bees seem to be working, right, and in a community. But the sense of obligation, the development of the person, you know, the choice, right? Mm. And it's interesting, too. You know, I think we see more and more this rise of people choosing to sort of opt out of work, too. You know, and what does that do to the human person, right? What does that do to you when you don't feel like you contribute? What does that do to you when you don't feel like, or when, like you said, you you break yourself into like, well, this is the work me and this is the life me and this is my friends me. You know, you're called, you are one person. How do you unify that? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a challenging thing because each one of those places has its own set of rules, right? I think that's what, when people say like, well, this is my work friends and these are my home friends. You know, the work has its own culture, right? And the way you act is bound by different rules at work than it is at home or than it is at like the sports bar with your friends in the evening. And so how do you remain the same person within all of those different contexts, right? And that ultimately comes down to what are the inherent values that you live by? Mm-hmm. You know, in us, it's our faith in Jesus Christ.
You know, looking at the church's teaching of Rerum Novarum on the dignity of the worker and just being in the workplace, you know, it talks a lot about how we're supposed to become a better version of ourselves in subduing the earth. We're supposed to be a better version of ourselves in that community, but also that prayer is a part of our work. And it reminds me so much of Saint Benedict saying, ora et labora, and you know, prayer at work and work at prayer. And that doesn't mean that you're firing off Hail Marys throughout the day, but when there's a difficult conversation with a colleague, that you're calling on our Lord, okay, help me to be patient. Help me not to just see myself and my anger, my frustration in this situation, but help me to see that person as well and to overcome the situation. You know, is the work of my hands, is this something that's truly good? Am I being truly objectively moral in this situation? Am I taking the time to talk to the people in my environment? There's so many pieces that we just separate out our work life in such a deep way, yet there are so many opportunities for growth.
But and you look at, you know, it's funny, as you're speaking, the prayer of St. Francis comes to mind, right? You know, grant that I may never seek so much to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand. And if you look at putting that into practice in your work life, you're gonna do well because of that. If you're the guy on the team who's seeking to understand where people are coming from, who's seeking to serve more than he's seeking to be served, that you're going to do well. It's going to serve you better than if you're the guy who's like, no, it's my way or the highway. And it's my opinion that matters because no one wants to work with that guy. Mm-hmm. And it's so, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes we try to put these false dichotomy between our faith and our work and our life. But the reality is the things that make you a good Christ follower, they're not going to hurt you in the world, right?
There shouldn't be division.
There isn't a division. And the more you integrate your faith, the more I integrate my faith into my work, the stronger person I am because I become more like Jesus. And let's face it, who wouldn't want to have Jesus as an employee or a boss, right? Like who wants, you know, and that's the thing we see. Jesus is he is infectious. Jesus is a wonderful person to be around. That's why we follow and worship. And that's not why we all follow and worship. But I mean, does it make sense? Like that's the call of the believer is to be an example, a living witness of Jesus Christ in the workplace. So that if people see you, they go, well, gosh, that's what Jesus, the accountant would look like. Right. And that is, you know, that integration is a challenge at times because the water cooler conversation gets a little blue or whatever's going on or, you know, the language is a little this and you want to fit in. And there's such that desire to fit in, but you can, you know, I mean, you can be part of the community. You can be in the world, but not of the world, mm-hmm. you know, and you can.
Absolutely. I want to talk for a second here about Serena Williams before we shut this conversation down about work, because when I saw what happened this weekend at the US Open and how at the Open final she lost and she ends up smashing her racket in the middle of the game, when she doesn't make the move that she wants, she ends up calling the ref a liar. She calls him a thief over a point. And then in the end, what she comes out with saying is, well, I'm a woman and I'm being discriminated against. I think she has something like $17,000 in fines, Chris.
Wow.
And here she is freaking out. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, you lost. And this ref is known for being very fair, hard, but very, very fair at the same time. And I'm looking at the whole story and I'm just thinking, Serena Williams, like, we get into this mentality where, well, I can't be wrong or I can't have lost because we put too much value on our work. So on one end, we need to respect our work and it's a fundamental part of who we are. But then sometimes we put too much value on who we are and what we've done, almost to the point where we don't mean to, but we treat the other person like they didn't deserve that, to the point where poor Naomi Osaka ends up crying when she's about to receive her award because people are booing her and because Serena Williams made such a big deal about it, almost making her feel like she didn't deserve it.
Yeah, I mean, my mind immediately goes to John McEnroe, who, you know, was famous for his tantrums in tennis. And I just, that's funny, because when I think of tennis, I think of temper tantrums just because of John McEnroe. Does that make sense? But I think you get to a strong point that when we begin to identify ourselves with our success, when we begin to, our value becomes tied up in our success, then losing is more than losing, right? It's an attack against my identity.
And that's what she took it as.
Oh, yeah.
She even commented at one point, Chris, to the ref saying, like, I am a mother. And she was emphasizing this, like, she felt in
that's
some
such
ways.
Such a weird thing to, I'm a mother. That's just a weird thing to say when you lose a tennis match.
But she put too much value at
saying. Oh, absolutely.
Like, she put everything of who she was. And I felt so bad because she sees Naomi cry and you see her. Like, I think that Serena Williams, giving her credit, ends up putting her arm around Naomi because you could tell, oh, whoa, I think this is suddenly came into perspective for her. It wasn't just that she was overwhelmed with emotion that she won,
right,
but the fact that she wasn't being treated as she should.
You know, it's interesting because Jesus' name literally is, you know, God saves. Like, he's the Savior. It's what he's come to do. It's who he is. But Jesus' identity, if you read the Gospels, is founded in who he is in the Father. You know what I mean? Even though our work, even though our success, even though our struggles, even though those things, our identity's to be the same as Jesus in that who we are in the Father. You know, see what love the Father has bestowed on us, that we may be called the children of God. That's where your dignity comes from. That's where your value comes from. It's because of who you are in him, who you are to him.
Chris and Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at C Mueller Tweets, spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R, and at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
So this next topic should matter to you because all of us have men in our lives. And it's important that we're understanding, whether you're a man, the way that you're thinking. You know, some people have commented, and I even hear comments on this book, that, wow, it's so liberating for me to understand that this is part of the way I function. I don't feel bad for it. Or I understand this is what's taking place. And on the flip side, women think, oh, well, that's just how men think. But the reality is if this is how they function, if this is the way that their brains are wired, not that we're always going to have this perfect space and time for each person to think, but that we respect and see another way of living and interacting. So that being said, Chris and I, over the last few weeks on the shows, have been talking about this book, For Women Only. Chris hates the title, but subtitle.
For Women Only.
You like the subtitle,
though. Subtitle's better. In fact, when I quote the book in my social media, I typically do not use the For Women Only. I just put, you know, what you need to know about the inner lives of men.
So it's by Shanti Feldhahn, and she's just excellent. She really backs what she says with a ton of research. It has a biblical worldview at the same time, but this next chapter that we're chewing on, and I'm going to encourage you guys, you've got to go back and listen to the other episodes, because we've been doing one segment pretty much every episode. This week, we're talking about what you need to know about the interior lives of men and the fact that women process things by talking them out a lot of the time. Not all women, but a lot of women. It's a sense of discovery in the conversation, versus for men, they process things in silence by working through the topic in their own head on their own, and then they're ready to talk it out.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I don't know that's, you know, it's funny because my relationship with my wife too, like, I've definitely encountered that from her too, where something will happen and I want to talk about it, but she needs to process.
Right.
You know, I think men maybe are more like that, but I think we all get like that, right? Where it's, you know, sometimes you're not ready. You can't form the, like me on this radio show right now. Sometimes you can't formulate the thought you want to say, right? And it's like, it's there. I know I'm not happy about something. I don't know how to express that to you right now. And if we continue to do this, I'm not going to say what I want to say or the way I want to say it.
And it's fascinating because it talks about how, you know, men process things differently. They need time to do this processing. In fact, a lot of studies showed that men take 7 times longer to process emotionally complex data than women, which is why often guys will be like, oh, you know, let me think about that or give me some space for this. And then the next morning, they'll be able to handle this. It's a typical of that time frame. But what's interesting is you see examples. And again, this isn't just meant to be taken in male-female relationships, but in relationships with your children, with colleagues, whatever it might be, And it's interesting because it talks about how often women tend to pursue men when they want to talk about something. And there's stories in the book where it talks about the wife, Shanti, would pursue her husband down the hall. Or you hear these stories.
Right.
And the guy's just trying to escape for a second to think about the thing and then also to process the emotion behind it.
Well, and I think also the context in which that conversation happens, too. You know, I think sometimes women have a tendency to be like, well, we need to talk about this right now. And you're like, we're at the grocery store. And I am absolutely not talking about this at the grocery store. Right? Because there is an emotional element to whatever you're processing, or, you know, or you're on a cell phone conversation in two different places. And like, no, we don't need to do this right now. Right. But yeah, women can be a little bit like, no, I needed to get it processed right now. Cause I need to get, they like, I want to touch it once. Right. Whereas a man needs time to process it. Now, conversely, if you don't deal with it, then your wife ends up kind of spinning on it, right? Like she can get caught in the loop of like going through and I can't stop thinking about it because we didn't process it and what's going on in your mind. Then you start to assume what women will do is they start assuming they know what he's thinking because he didn't say anything. So I know what he's thinking, you know, like, and it becomes this whole thing and you're like, no, just breathe, you know, like, but it's true. And, you know, it's funny when we got married, one of the best pieces of advice we were given was you can never assume you know why your spouse did something or what they thought, mm-hmm. right? And I think I've mentioned that before, but,
right.
you know, well, he didn't say anything because he didn't care, blah, 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 blah. Or, you know, I came home and she didn't notice my haircut because she doesn't see me anymore, blah, 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 blah. You know, and you don't know, right? And so I think what one of the strong points of this is you can't assume you know what's going on in that person's head. You know, mm-hmm. and how much struggle do we have in our daily lives in our relationship with our spouses because we assume we know what the other person is thinking or that their motive was somehow tainted. You know,
there's a really interesting story in the book that I love. So the author, Shanti, jokes that she ends up using her friends as experiments sometimes because as she was writing the book, she'd really start chewing on these things. And so one of the things she says is that 7 out of 10 men need space to process and think through things through. This is in the polling. That's what came out of it. But what she discovered is that men really are very deep thinkers. It's just not the same way as women often. And so much so that she was just flabbergasted by how deeply men think through things, but often even how they think through the responses that other people will have to what they're saying. And so one example, she mentions being at her friend's house, they're in the kitchen, and the husband comes back, I think he was dirt biking or something, and he comes in and he's just muddy everywhere. He walks right in this beautiful porcelain, clean, sparkly sink. He grabs this white rag and starts wiping down his shoes and his legs. And the wife is just on the verge of just freaking out. And all of a sudden, Shanti steps in and just says, hold on a second. She puts her arms out and is like, wait a second here. And she looks at the husband and says, tell me exactly what you were thinking.
Right.
And he tells her, well, he goes, I was thinking that I have a meeting. I'm going to be late. I really got to wipe off this dirt. I noticed that rag this morning and I was thinking that it's looking a little tattered. So I figured I'd wipe off my legs and then throw the rag in the hamper. And then tomorrow morning I'd buff the car out with it when I wash the car.
Right.
And the wife's response is, oh, she was just about to say something like, what were you thinking?
Right.
But he had thought through it. And he even thought through the fact that she was going to respond negatively, but he didn't have a lot of time.
Right. Yeah. Again, it goes back to that assuming motive. Like you don't know what the other person is thinking. And so a lot of times, yeah, your husband comes in and he's maybe left his socks on the floor or whatever it is. But because he wasn't thinking about the socks. He was thinking about 3 steps later about he's running late. And if he doesn't get out the door in 5 minutes, he's going to be late to work. He's going to hear about it from his boss. He's going to do this. And there's a whole process there. And yes, probably could have started earlier, but like it's not always about the socks, you know, or the rag or whatever it is, you
or
know?
The nail. I said last week, we've got to watch that video. It's not about the nail.
Right. Yeah.
I'll have to post that. Check out my Facebook. I'll post it this week.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it's, I think one of the things that women do, and it's funny, I've been doing nothing but parent nights this month. I've done different mm-hmm. parent nights at different churches and schools, you know, I'm talking to a lot of parents. And I think the tendency is, you know, I'll have women come up and talk about their husbands, right? Because a lot of times husband isn't there. And there's that push. And a lot of times, you know, what I'll say is, you know, what about what you're saying is going to put him on a defensive, Mm-hmm. You know, I want you to think about what he's hearing, not about what you're saying. Because women tend to think about like what they need to say, right? Mm-hmm. But you stop for a second and go, what do you think he's hearing? What's he going to hear? What about the way you're saying that? Is he going to misinterpret? You know, and it's amazing when you start thinking that way, it changes the conversation, right? You know, and so you, a lot of times if there's like a couple who's like in intense argument, if you stop and go, well, what is he reacting to? What am I doing that he's reacting to? And how can I, you know, how can I say this in a way that maybe he's going to feel affirmed and respected and all those things. Mm-hmm. But the chasing a man down the hallway, like, you know, we can talk about this right now. Oh, that ain't going to go well. You know, like if think about it, like any other creature in the wild, right? Like
you're like, dead.
Don't corner. Don't, you know, if the dog is growling and trying to get space, it's because it's feeling threatened. If you're in your relationship and like, we need to talk about this right now. And he's walking down the hallway and like, I can't talk about this right now. Don't chase him to corner. Right? Like it's probably not going to go well.
And his intention is good in walking away. And that's what was so emphasized, that most of the time when they walk away, it's because they don't want to say something that they don't mean, because they're feeling forced to say something. They don't want to say something hurtful. So here are the things that can help recognizing these processing difference. And you guys, you have to know that this is taking place also on a neurological level, the way the brains are mapped differently, the wiring of the brains. And so this is part of the reason why there's a difference here. And so one of the first things is basically know that he thinks before he's got to talk things through, and that he's going to process each thing separately. He's going to separately process through talking things out, separately process through thinking about it, and also separately process the feeling about what's going on. It's not all three at once, and that's something she really emphasized.
I think what too, it kind of along those lines, you know, and this book has kind of emphasized this at various points, but men are extremely emotional. Right?
She really emphasized.
Oh, yeah. And so a lot of times what a man is dealing with is his emotional response to something, right? Mm-hmm. How do I feel? How do I say that in a way that's not going to... And what happens is too often, I think, when a man does vocalize how he's feeling, it's like he's in trouble because of it, right? Like, and so how do you, you know, like, you know, rather, again, it's that like, am I hearing what you're saying or am I reacting to it, right? And you know, so what, where's that? Like men have a hard time expressing their emotions. They need to, right? They need the space to do it. And so often when there's a situation where a couple's at each other's throats, when he does get to the point where he can express his emotion, it's like that is seen by a lot of times by his wife as like an attack, right? Mm. And a lot of that's not it. It's just, this is where I'm at, right? And so, you know, that idea of listening on both parts, I think men and women, is really important, you know?
Absolutely. So another piece that she says is really make sure that he has time to do this. And, you know, then hopefully he will be able to articulate those emotions, because I think that you're right. A lot of people think, well, you're not supposed to feel anything. And I think that there's sometimes this degrading attitude toward men that I see, where it's like, you're almost like a tool. And that you're meant to provide, you're meant to do all these different things, but then you're not allowed to feel. Right. And those feelings, just like our own, we should be allowed to feel what we feel. You can't change your feelings. You can change how you react to them, but you can't necessarily change your feelings about something.
You know, it's interesting. My dad is a deacon in the church and a preacher, and he always talked about how God wants a relationship with little Bobby, not with Robert, right? And I think when in marriage, when you're dealing with the emotions of your husband, you have to understand there's a little boy inside of every man who just wants to be heard and loved.
This has been Trending with Chris and Timmery. To learn more about Chris Mueller or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak at your upcoming event, visit everydaycatholic.com or timmery.com.